Hi, this is Uli John Roth from England. You're listening to Eric Jackson Lurie on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Enjoy.
Quartz in session here in WRCT 88.3 FM, streaming online at WRCT.org. A big shout out to Kenny Wayne Shepherd coming to the Palace Theater April 19th. Gonna be a great show. If you missed any part of tonight's show, well, you can catch it again tomorrow night, 1:30 in the morning after Viva La Mock, after the mockster does his weekly mock and spins the best and worst of punk, power pop, country, you name it, he's got it. Does a great show every week. Fridays at 9, Courts in Session afterwards, 1:30 in the morning. And Sunday night at 10, replay of tonight's show. Your buddy loves Kenny Wayne Shepherd and missed it. Well, I'll tell him tune in Sunday night at 10. Can hear it all over again. So, guys, we promised we're closing tonight celebrating the music, the legacy of Ace Frehley. Of course, in the background, Kiss with Ace's tune, Cold Gin. These songs are your requests. I've got room for maybe one or two more. So if you got an Ace song that you love, solo, from Kiss, you name it, I'll play it. 412-268-9728. 412-268-WRCT. Let's go back to 1980 from the Unmasked album. This is Ace Frehley and Kiss. Talk to me.
Start to quiver and
listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, and these are your requests tonight, celebrating the music of Ace Frehley. In the background from Ace's most recent album, 10,000 Volts, Cherry Medicine. Were you at the Ace Frehley Wicked Show? Oh gosh, less than 2 months ago at Jurgles. Well, I was there, and if you were, you know what a terrific show that was. Ace was the king of cool and just sounded absolutely terrific. You make me feel better when you're in your black leather. And WRCT is supported by Row House Cinema. Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater in the historic Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Each week, they choose a new movie theme ranging from classic cult, foreign animation, fantasy, and more. Their concessions feature natural popcorn with real butter, craft beer, and vegan options. Row House Cinema is located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, you can visit their website at rowhousecinema.com. Or call 412-904-3225. Row House Cinema, our sponsor for the final portion of tonight's show. And if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, well, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. So this next song is a bit of an anomaly for me. Came out in 1989, going out to Jennifer in West Deer. Kiss recorded this song and released it as a single. So what did Ace do? He recorded a solo album and did the same thing. This is Hide Your Heart, WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. We'll be right back. Gentlemen, it's that time. What do you say we close out with a little Ace Frehley Rocket Ride? Oh, I love that. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. And courts in session is now courts adjourned. I want to remind you, take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. Let's get back together next week. Rest in peace, Ace. Good night, Pittsburgh.
For the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the One World of Community Radio.
WRHU Hempstead, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar. Joining with me is Ricky Hubert. Joining us today from the UK is Gavin Bruce, Chief Executive of the International Animal Rescue. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's a pleasure, Cody. Thanks for the intro.
Sir, I'd love to hear a little bit more about, for our listeners who may not be familiar with International Animal Rescue, what is it that you do? And what can people learn about?
Yeah, so International Rescue, we've been around for about 30 years. We work on specific projects around the world, protecting wildlife from an animal welfare perspective, but also from a conservation perspective. So our first big international project was in India. There was a rather gruesome dancing bear trade, which people may be aware of, where bears are kept as sort of kept in captivity and danced by the side of the road for entertainment. This is a practice that had gone on for probably 500 years. And we worked with a local partner and the Indian government to try and stop this because it's very brutal. The cubs are poached from the wild. They were kept in captivity. They had their teeth knocked out. They had a red hot poker put through their nose with a piece of rope to kind of make them dance. And really, they're not dancing. They're kind of really in pain. So we set up a project where we built some sanctuaries for the bears that were in captivity to go in. But most importantly, we worked with the communities that were dancing the bears so that if they surrendered their bear, they would get alternative livelihood training and also support for their families so that the need for the bear for money disappeared. And actually, they ended up with a much better life, education for their children and a much more stable income than they had with the bear. So it was a kind of win-win, really, because I guess these things have kind of gone out of fashion a bit. Overseas tourists were not so interested in this kind of stuff. So they weren't making very much money. They were eking out an existence, really, and the bears were in terrible suffering. So we set up this project and we rescued 700 bears from the roadsides of India. They were moved into three different sanctuaries in Agra, Bangalore and Bhopal. Thousands of people benefited from a retraining program and a sort of community development program. And now, you know, up until now, these bears are now living, you know, a much more comfortable life. But more importantly, it stopped the trade. So we started in 2002. We rescued the last dancing bear from the streets of India in 2009. And there are now no dancing bears in India. So it was we ended it by having a very holistic approach, working with government, working with local people, supporting the community and giving good care for the bears for the rest of their life. So it was a welfare project, but also obviously now there's not that demand for bears being poached from the wild. So it's has a good conservation angle as well. So that was kind of where we started. Based on that experience, we worked in Indonesia, mainly starting off working with primates, particularly macaques that were, again, really being used for, kept as pets or used for entertainment. And we set up a program to rescue the macaques, often surrendered or they were confiscated by the authorities, rehabilitate them into troops and then release them back into the wild. So slightly different from the bears, where, you know, the bears were so badly damaged physically and emotionally that they were never going to be viable to be released into the wild. We're now into a program where we can release these animals back into the wild. That grew into working with other primates like the slow loris, which very cute looking animal, very, very popular in the illegal pet trade, smuggled all over Southeast Asia and beyond, but very rare, highly endangered. Again, working with the authorities, working with local people. We have a rehabilitation centre in Indonesia, working again with a local group where we can kind of bring the animals in and wherever possible release them back into the wild. And it kind of moved us from an animal welfare approach to, once you start working with endangered wildlife, you really, there's a sort of conservation angle as well. So you've got to be always trying to address the root cause of the problem. Why are these animals needing rescuing in the first place? No one wants to rescue animals. We want to stop it from happening. So, you know, a lot of our work has been around raising awareness, education, trying to sort of change hearts and minds so that, you know, it's not cool to keep these animals as pets. And we've had a lot of success with that. A lot of these animals have disappeared from the market. We're seeing less of it based on these very intensive education awareness programs done locally with local people, schools, groups, etc. That work in Indonesia then sort of moved on to work with orangutans in Borneo. So the main issue with orangutans was less about the pet trade. It was more about habitat loss. There was quite a lot of deforestation, certainly a sort of decade ago or so, that a lot of the tree cover had been lost on the island over the previous sort of 30, 40 years. Obviously, you know, if you remove the habitat, you're going to impact the biodiversity that's living in there. And there was a lot of animals being displaced. You've got these sort of large apes coming out, you know, being displaced from the forest and sort of moving into sort of communities and causing problems where, you know, inevitably they're going to come into conflict. And what would often happen back then was, you know, if it was a mother and a baby, the mother would be killed, the baby might be taken in as a pet, but it was more opportunistic. We set up a program whereby we started to work with the communities, understand the conflict situation, work with them on that. And the infants, I mean, having a baby orangutan is quite cute, but they soon get pretty big and pretty impossible to sort of keep around. And they'd end up just chained up outside, you know, outside someone's house, because they're so powerful, these animals. They become quite dangerous. So we set up a program of rehabilitation, again, built a rescue centre in Borneo, brought in these infants that were being displaced. And it was really the sticking plaster. It was the how do we come up with a system where we can at least get these animals back into the wild, also have a team of people working on prevention. How can we stop the rescuing? How can we work with communities, work with landowners to try and maintain the forest so that the need for the rescue starts to be mitigated? The thing with orangutans is they spend a long time. An infant orangutan spends 7 or 8 years with its mother in the wild. So if you take an infant in that's, you know, just a few months old, you're into a long rehabilitation process, because you, in a rescue centre, have now got to replicate all that learning that the infant would have had by living with its mum for 7 or 8 years. So it's a long haul. And over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, a lot of these infants that came in 10 years ago have now been rehabilitated and released back into the forest. And I'm pleased to say that they're going into safe areas, national parks, and they're doing really well. You know, they really have adapted well. They're completely independent, living in the forest. And we're actually seeing some of the females that have been released having babies in the wild. So it's a kind of a amazing story, having infants come in, spend all those years with us, learning, becoming independent, not becoming habituated, not becoming reliant on humans, and then being released, monitored, and then eventually having their own offspring in the wild. So we're repopulating a a diminished population. So that's a really exciting program, and there's a huge amount of work going on with local communities, the people that live around the forests that, you know, have farms or other, you know, there's other land use. There's a big problem with fires across Asia, forest fires, and it's really working with people on more sustainable land use, more sustainable agriculture. It's beneficial for them, and it's beneficial for the nature. And I have this sort of thing I say, you know, if you invest in people, you invest in nature, because, you know, most people aren't going out to destroy nature. They're just trying to make a living. And if you can support their farming, support their families, support their livelihoods, then actually the impact on nature is reduced. And there's a huge amount of community-led initiatives across Indonesia that we've worked on with a local team there that's been hugely, hugely beneficial. And we're seeing massive impact, massive reduction on encroachment, illegal logging, poaching, all the things that are detrimental. And we're seeing the livelihoods of the people involved improving, which is amazing. And it's sort of much more holistic approach to conservation than just going around rescuing stuff forever, because you never keep up with that.
And so, Gavin, you were saying about where you do work. How do you find these communities all over the world, wherever they may be, whether it is in Indonesia or Asia? How do you find the communities that you work in? How do you pick your causes, so to speak?
Yeah, it's been, I mean, to be honest with you, we've tended, rather than sort of go too wide and have a sort of scattergun approach, because there's hundreds and hundreds of groups we could work with and ways in which we could support different projects. But the way we've evolved, and it has really been an evolution, is really creating partnerships from the very beginning. So all the work we really do, we've not just sort of come in and provided some funding. You know, we've been there from the kind of inception of the idea. And it is really from a network of people. Obviously, you know, working in India, we sort of got to know groups working in Asia. We met a brilliant vet called Carmela Yana Sanchez, who is the program or the CEO of the Indonesian organization, the ASAN, that we work with there. And we've really kind of, you know, it has gone from, you know, a relatively small program working with macaques, and just by sort of doing a good job and building up a level of trust both with the government and with the communities, rather than go off and try and do something else somewhere else, it's that program has become established as the people that work with primates, work on the pet trade. And it's quite a systematic approach that's gone on. You know, it's a 20-year relationship now that's gone from, as I say, rescuing a few macaques at the beginning to now having rescued thousands and released thousands of animals, building these long-term relationships with the communities within which we work, and building a big team. Probably got 400 people in Indonesia now that are working on, you know, everything from physically looking after the animals that are either in our rehabilitation program that hopefully will be released one day, or there are always some animals that are never going to be released for you know, whatever reason. So the small sanctuary animals, as we call them. But a team working on the awareness, a team working on sort of illegal wildlife trade and the enforcement and law, you know, law enforcement and investigations, a teamwork. Yeah, no, it's a big team of people, but it's very cross-functional. It's, you know, everything from people sort of sitting alongside facilitators working in the community, you know, working alongside the community, all local people. You know, it's unlike some organizations send a load of foreigners over to try and tell everybody what to do. It's not like that at all. Everybody there is from, I don't just mean from Indonesia, for example, they're from those communities that are working that understand the kind of pressures and the hot, you know, what are the stress points that we could maybe help with some training on, something as simple as organic farming. I mean, I went to a farm a couple of years ago, and we'd done some organic farming training and had done a demonstration plot and done a basically split a paddy field down the middle and by supporting the family and with this project, you could see, I was there for, it was kind of like the harvest festival for the rice. And you can see that the area that had had the organic farming approach compared to what they were doing before, the yield was twice as much. So now you've got a family that instead of just about surviving and growing enough rice for their family, they've now got rice they can sell in the market. It means there's less pressure on them to then go off and do other, you know, hunting and having to use more land, which encroaches into the forest. And so it's a really supportive sort of community-based approach. There's a fabulous project called Power of Mama, which is, it's a bunch of ladies from the communities in Indonesia that are supporting fire prevention. And these are mothers, grandmothers. They've got a uniform. It's a fabulous female empowerment project. It's all females. And they literally go around the farming communities, making sure that the guys farming aren't doing slash and burn. They're not burning the crops, and which can be that it's all deep peat there. So it's very risky from a wildfire perspective. But these are the women from these communities. They're the women that have seen the forest fires. They've seen the impact it has on their kids' health. They've seen the impact it has on the wildlife. They've seen the impact it has on the forest and the farms. And we're kind of just providing the facilitation for this amazing group of people. And they're quite formidable. They're riding around, you know, beating up the guys, telling them to stop, you know, burning stuff and giving them a hard time when they don't behave themselves. And it's gone from a few ladies to 100 strong now, and they've got a uniform. And it's completely voluntary, but it's just that sort of embedding these sort of environmental sort of priorities into day-to-day life. And a lot of work with the kids, you know, conservation camps, education, providing education. You know, we have an after schools program where the kids can come along and learn other skills, learn English, learn computing, just giving them access to life skills that they just wouldn't have from their day-to-day schooling. So it's a very broad, very holistic approach. So as going back to your question about how do we choose, it's more about depth, and it's about developing these things from almost the beginning to a proper holistic solution where you can really measure impact for both people, nature and the environment over time. And we'd rather then scale that up than then go off and do something completely different somewhere else.
So Gavin, I wanted to know, you know, for example, we know that with organization, we've seen it with as soon as Trump administration came through, all of a sudden there was a cut of funding. You know, did it affect you or as an organization, since you guys deal internationally, or it was one of those things like you would have to get funding because of the beautiful work that you guys are doing?
It's a really, really good question. Thank you. All of our funding comes from, there is some sort of government-to-government funding. So there was some money coming in from USAID and some of the people like US Fish and Wildlife and some of the divisions in the US government. I mean, obviously, that has changed. Vast majority of our funding comes from either private trusts and foundations or individual giving. You know, particularly at this end and in the US, you know, it's money coming in from individuals, whether it's adopting an animal on our website or it's a, you know, more philanthropic kind of relationship. There's a real mix. So we have quite a broad mix of income, but across the piece, obviously, you know, there was significant funding coming into some of the countries where we work from some of these international development programs, including the US, which, you know, that obviously has changed. We have seen an impact, and it has had an impact on some of the projects we were running, and it's And it's not just the US, you know, there are other, the UK's changed its international development approach as well. So it's, yeah, it's quite challenging because obviously some of these, the reality is, you know, the, you've got developing countries that are doing a, yeah, they're trying to do the right thing. You know, they're trying, you know, in the West, we developed and, you know, we developed the way we developed 100 years ago, and the economy was looked very different to how it looks now. What we know looks very different, you know, what we know now we didn't know then. And if we want to help these countries develop in a way that's more sustainable, then there's almost like a subsidy, isn't there? It's kind of, you know, if it's bad for the planet to chop down all the rainforests, which it no doubt is from a climate change or biodiversity impact, some of these countries are kind of source of their GDP, whether it's timber or agriculture or mining or whatever it is that they're using the land for. So if we don't want to do that, there's a kind of equation where you've got to support them to do it in a different way that it is beneficial to the sort of wider global environmental agenda. But, you know, obviously that was happening, that agenda has shifted a little bit, so, you know, we're just adapting with it. I mean we're very much, you know, we're not a big policy making organization. For us, it's very much grassroots projects, because for our, you know, we believe that if you start with the people on the ground that are living in this environment, whether it's the guys dancing the bears in India, the people keeping animals as pets, the farmers that are sort of encroaching in the forest, you know, whoever it is, if you can invest in them, support them, understand their pressures, you know, you can sort of create a tangible benefit for them and for nature and the environment. But yeah, I mean, clearly there has been an impact of the way funding is. We haven't kind of seen it shake out yet fully, but some of those taps have certainly been turned off.
I'm curious also, Gavin, like with the way that different governments are responding to the climate crisis, how that also in your conservation work, making sure that, hey, if we are taking these animals out of captivity, that there's actually habitats for them to return to. What has that kind of been over the past few years?
Yeah, no, I mean, I sort of, it's interesting. I've been to some of the COP conferences, and particularly the biodiversity conference and the global biodiversity framework that was sort of signed off in at COP15, which was in Montreal a few years ago. And it kind of struck me a little bit that these things are still talked about as separate things. You know, they're talked about as an issue with biodiversity, and then there's obviously the big COP climate agenda with the Paris Accord and all the various annual meetings that go on, and you talk about climate change, and then you've got sort of big global health discussions around pandemics, which sort of really comes from the sort of World Health Organization. And for me, these things are just all linked together, because the biggest threat to biodiversity is climate change. One of the biggest mitigators for climate change is are nature-based solutions, you know, forest, peatlands, oceans. These are the biggest sinks of carbon, and if we can kind of protect those, then actually we go a long way to mitigating climate change. And our relationship with nature has a direct relationship with the health of humanity. So spillover of pathogens, as we've seen with the famous pandemic, but all the other sort of nasty pathogens that end up in the sort of human interface, it's really that sort of a sort of lack of respect of how these complex systems work. And if you kind of mess with nature, it kind of bites back a little bit. And I don't mean that in a flippant way. It's kind of, these pathogens exist in the wild and in a natural state, and the wildlife is evolutionary designed to cope with it. But then, of course, when we remove habitat and animals start to move, it's well documented, this spillover. The more interfaces you get between humans and farming, livestock, etc., and sort of nature, you run the risk of pathogens spilling over. So it's not sensationalizing it, it's just kind of common sense that for the sake of sort of human well-being, you know, and if it's, even if I'm being completely selfish and it's all about me and maybe my kids, then protecting biodiversity and having a healthy respect for nature and then the benefits that has for the climate, it just kind of makes sense to me. And that's kind of the way I think of it, that these are these three things, human health, biodiversity and climate change, are totally interconnected, and they're all sort of different dimensions of the same issue, and it's sort of just trying to move to a slightly more sustainable way of living.
And with that, Gavin, you set us up excellent for the rest of this interview, because something you were saying before, when you were talking about the educational resources, this is, although it's the International Animal Rescue, involves animals and the environment and things of that nature, this is very much a people-powered movement. And you mentioned in the beginning, your whole goal is to change hearts and minds and to get people on board, and your education, there's educational resources on your website. How do you get the naysayers who might not necessarily see your point of view to get on the bandwagon of the great work that you're doing with the International Animal Rescue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's, I think, you know, we're, the debate comes around the causes, doesn't it? I think people are, you know, most people, you know, love animals. You know, we have our pets, we have our sort of relationship. We have a relationship with animals. It might be different animals in different parts of the world. You know, it might be the wildlife. It might be the birds singing in the tree. So we, you know, I think as a human race, we have a sort of bond with animals. So it's then just trying to sort of link up that actually it's not so hard. We're not asking people to change their lives. We're just asking people to think a little bit about their relationship with animals and nature, and by sort of using the animals that people can, you know, we do a lot of work with bears, but people, I mean, they're quite big, vicious animals, but I think because we all, I don't know whether it's because we all are given a teddy bear as a baby, people love them, you know. It's kind of it's trying to find ways to get people to engage more with